Welcome to Goals Question Time, where I interview leading executives driving innovation, venturing, and strategic change. So today for Goals Question Time, I've got the pleasure of being at Distill Ventures with Frank Lampen, who is the founder of Independence United and Distill Ventures. Hi, Frank.
Hi there.
So, Frank, if you could, first of all, give us a bit of an introduction, please, to Independence United and how that's come about.
Sure. So we've been going for about 9 years, and we're really a specialist in innovation, helping companies when they're looking for the big shifts, the new business models, the discontinuous growth opportunities. And I guess we're different from the sort of big consulting firms in that we are very much around sort of helping you get some change underway. So we sort of specialise in not just sort of identifying what the need for change is and what the change opportunity might be, but actually piloting some programmes and getting them up and running. And of course, increasingly, you find that a lot of the innovation is happening in startups and outside of the big corporate. So obviously one of the ways in which we can help companies get change underway and find some discontinuous growth opportunities is to do the right kind of partnerships with startups who might have new business models, new products, or big sort of process changes for them that can help them unlock some sort of kind of change within their industry and their sector.
And you're using corporate venturing as the sort of activity to do this.
Yeah, I mean we're not exclusively focused on corporate venturing, but it does actually come into a lot of the projects we do because I mean for one very simple reason in that you find that a lot of the best talent these days wants to be their own boss and go into a startup. So whereas 15, 20 years ago, sort of joining a big graduate scheme of one of the big ad agencies or one of the consultancies or one of the big consumer packaged goods companies was seen as being the sort of best career option out of university, it very much isn't now. And so you find that if you're in a big corporate and you're looking to change and develop what you do and what your services are and what your products are, that actually that involves looking outside of the corporation.
Okay, so in today's interview, I'm based here with you at Distill Ventures, and we can see a lot of the brands and that around from them. So how did Distill Ventures come about? Give us a bit of context about that.
Yeah, so one of the things about IU is we'd always invested off our own balance sheet. So we'd already had experience of investing in some of the startups we were involved with, had been through accelerator programs. So we were really familiar with the model in the tech space. And we just sort of started thinking about other places where you could apply this model of mixing money with expertise and with mentoring, and that the combination of the three really helping businesses accelerate. Mm-hmm. So we looked for businesses and sectors where a lot of the innovation was happening outside of big corporates, but where the big corporate might have some areas of expertise that could be really helpful for small startups. And often that expertise is technical expertise. Sometimes it can be around regulation and licenses to operate. Sometimes that expertise can be access to route to market. So we looked at a bunch of sectors, and drinks is a sector where it's been tremendous innovation in the past 20 years, and most of that innovation of new-to-world brands has been born from outside of the big drinks companies. Incredible kind of entrepreneurial activity and spirit. But it also meets the criteria of it's quite difficult for those entrepreneurs once you get beyond a certain scale because you're no longer selling yourself on being sort of new and interesting and small and craft. You start needing access to really big amounts of working capital. You start getting into really big logistical challenges around buying your glassware and producing your liquid and shipping it around the world.
Right, yep.
You start having to understand import regulations and label regulations in 30 markets rather than one or two.
Right.
So for those entrepreneurs, there comes a point where actually it becomes very, very difficult doing it on your own. So it's a classic case of a sector where easy to start up on your own, hard to scale globally on your own, and therefore it's one where corporate venturing makes a lot of sense. So we worked with a lot of entrepreneurs we knew who were in the space to understand their needs, and then we took it to Diageo as an idea, and they said yes.
So Distill Ventures, that's 100% being done for Diageo?
It is, yeah. So one of the things about the alcohol sector that's different from perhaps other sectors where corporate venturing operates is that there are a small number of global alcohol companies, and therefore it's a space where an investment model which has acquisition as its end goal makes sense.
Right. Yeah.
Not only makes sense, but it's also acceptable to entrepreneurs, because if you're launching a drinks brand with the ambition that it becomes global, there's probably only five or six companies you're going to end up selling
right.
to anyway.
Yeah.
So going and doing a deal with the biggest company saying, look, you put up the money for this, but the money will come with a call option for you to acquire it when it reaches a certain scale. That makes sense for Diageo, because it means that effectively it's taking an early option on some really good opportunities out in the marketplace. And it makes sense for the entrepreneurs, because Diageo is the biggest spirits company in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it, by investing in an early stage, it means we can structure the deal in a way where really the deal for the entrepreneur is incredibly good in terms of having capital which is relatively cheap and non-dilutive for them, and an attractive exit option. So we're able to get the balance to, we think, a good place where the entrepreneur is limiting themselves to an extent by going with one partner.
Right, yeah.
But actually, on balance, when you look at everything that's on the table, it really is a sort of best-in-class deal that they could hope to get anyway.
And that model of acquisition and the metrics and that for the valuations are relatively straightforward in that place.
It is. I mean, there's a fairly standard model in drinks, which is the basis for pretty much every transaction that's done. So that model is really good, because it gives a very single-minded focus to the entrepreneur of what they're expected to do. They're expected to achieve a certain sales volume, but not to achieve that at the expense of cutting the price and discounting, and to be as efficient with marketing spend as possible. So that, if you like, is the formula of what makes a brand attractive to be bought, and it's relatively easy to encapsulate that formula in a fairly simple valuation mechanism.
So this is run as a separate unit outside of Diageo. Can you tell us a bit more about how that structure operates then?
Sure. So Distill Ventures is independent, but it does exist solely to execute this opportunity from Diageo. So how it's structured is that we market the opportunities globally. We find the entrepreneurs. Diageo will make the investment directly off its own balance sheet, but we will facilitate that process. So effectively, we will take the deal terms which have been tabled by Diageo. We will discuss those with the entrepreneurs. We'll work with the entrepreneur and Diageo to highlight any tailoring that might be needed for specific deal cases.
Mm-hmm.
Conclude the deal. So we're FCA regulated in the UK to enable us to do that, as acting
right.
as the intermediary.
Okay.
And then we take the lead on running the accelerator part of it, which is then all the support that the entrepreneurs get thereafter. And that puts us in what we think of a best of both worlds position, in that we can structure Distill Ventures with the needs of the entrepreneurs first and foremost. And that involves all sorts of things which might be harder to achieve in a corporation. So, for instance, one is security of tenure, in that the entrepreneurs know that the people they're building a relationship with when they're bought into the program and receive the investment are committed to this for the next 10 years. They're not going to disappear in 18 months or 2 years' time. So we're able to really create an environment which is structured around the entrepreneurs, which runs on its own very entrepreneurial culture. And yet, as Distill Ventures, we then serve as the access point to draw expertise from Diageo when the entrepreneur needs it.
Mm-hmm.
And we've sort of built really good networks within Diageo to access all sorts of expertise, from technical, regulatory, legal, IP and trademark issues. But we can go and access that exactly when the entrepreneur needs it, and ensure that it's being given to the entrepreneur in a very sort of efficient, well-packaged way. So we think that this sort of structure of being independent and really attuned to entrepreneurs, but draw on the best of Diageo, really works in our case.
And the life cycle of these brands or technologies or business you're building, are there different periods of life cycles, or what's the?
Yeah, I mean, typically, I think to grow a business in spirits with a strong brand to a point where it makes sense for a company like Diageo to acquire it and integrate it into their system, you're typically looking at a time horizon of, if you were really going at it fast, maybe 4 years, but typically more like 5, 6, 7 years
right.
To get to an interesting scale.
Okay. So do you think there'll be more sort of separate units in that in the future, and how this work?
I think there are some corporates who've set up units internally and who are phenomenally good at what they do and really sort of specialise in it and create a great environment for entrepreneurs. But we have come across cases where we've spoken to entrepreneurs where they've been in that classic situation of they've met one group of people and started working with them, and 18 months later they've all moved into different roles internally within the corporate, and they're working with other people, and the relationships perhaps aren't as good. And so I think that for corporates to create an environment which is really focused on the needs of entrepreneurs, you have to make some big changes to that corporate culture and corporate structures to make that work. And that's going to be increasingly important, because as more entrants come into the space and as the number of accelerators increase, the best startups are going to actually have offers from multiple places where they could go and join. And if you're a corporate, you don't want to be just entering that battle with financial firepower, because it can get very expensive and start tipping the deal metrics into a place which are uneconomic. So if you're not only offering good financial terms, but you're offering an environment which is perfectly set up for entrepreneurs, smart entrepreneurs are going to see that and are going to make smart choices about the type of culture they want to work in and operate in.
Mm-hmm. And have you got any specific examples yet of ones that have been through the full process of an entrepreneur or a brand that you can talk about?
Not yet, no. So we're 2 years from our first investment decisions.
Right.
We've got some really good numbers in terms of follow-on funding. It's around sort of 50% of companies have received follow-on already, which is great. So we've got the first brands we think are on track for reaching the target level for acquisition in the right time frames, but that's still a couple of years away from when we think that.
And the orders of magnitude in the follow-on funding, or the initial investment and then the follow-on.
Yeah, so we the seed stage we try and make simple for everyone. So we offer that on a relatively fixed term sheet of £175,000 investment for 20% equity stake.
Right.
But all follow-on funding which comes after that comes in either as a non-voting preference share or a convertible loan, which converts on acquisition. And the terms of that conversion, there is a discount, but actually doing the conversion at acquisition is much more advantageous to the entrepreneur and the founding shareholders in terms of protecting them against dilution.
Right.
And we do that for a number of reasons. One is we want to offer the best terms in the marketplace and to beat other sources of finance. But the more important thing is we want the entrepreneur to stay in that feeling that they are in control and running the business.
Yes.
So we don't want a situation where either they wake up every day feeling like they earn a little bit less and they earn a little bit less.
Yes.
Or be in a situation where there's an expansion opportunity, but they don't want to kind of take follow-on funding because they don't want to sort of move from being 54% down to being 47%
yes.
and lose control. So we don't want to create a barrier to them taking on investment. So our solution to that is offer them really cheap follow-on funding and then encourage them to be really aggressive. And that follow-on funding can range from sort of several hundred thousand pounds up into the millions. And we are looking at sort of much bigger investments now, because when you go into aged spirits, such as aged rum or aged whiskey, obviously the working capital needs are much higher. And so some of those deals will be in the millions of pounds.
Yeah, but that still sounds relatively cheap for some of these large corporates like Diageo in building a brand in terms of their marketing or their advertising budgets and stuff like that. So it's still...
I think you know, the when you look at what's happened in the entrepreneurial space, a big driver for a company like Diageo saying yes to this is a recognition that the way brands are built is changing.
Yes.
And perhaps the way that big corporates have built brands in an era of TV advertising and, you know, a small number of large retailers sort of dominating the retail space is very different from the landscape now, where actually retail channels are changing radically. The world of kind of brands within retail is sort of changing radically, in particularly in sort of food and drink. So entrepreneurs have emerged who are building brands in very, very different ways.
Yeah.
And certainly those sort of ways are much more efficient than perhaps the sort of big corporate way of doing it.
Yeah. And certainly, you're back to your point, you were just making about term sheets and stuff like that. Certainly what I'm seeing on the academy, corporate venturing academy programs that I'm seeing, the corporates getting their heads around some of those implications of the term sheets and the deals and what happens on the relationship with the entrepreneurs is such an important thing to understand when you start on this journey.
Absolutely.
That's so important.
Absolutely.
So what do you see as the implications for the models that you've sort of created and how things are moving on now?
So I think one of the things we sort of learned both in the process of setting up Distill Ventures, but also just being sort of out in the industry and at things such as the Corporate Venturing Symposium, that there's been this sort of recurring theme around value. So how do you build value for the parent? How do you sell that value in? How do you measure it? How do you create the right internal support? One of the things that sort of struck us is that probably one of the things we learned was that the value that Diageo see in Distill Ventures now was probably in some slightly different places from where we thought they would see it when we started that selling.
Right, yeah.
So we actually did a bit of an exercise to map different areas of value, and what's quite interesting is you can sort of kind of arrive at a sort of map of value which does kind of capture the sort of big areas, and they sort of split into some which are more near-term and short-term value, such as things like cultural change, accessing new technologies that you could apply already to your customer base or to your route to market, and then some which are much longer term value creation, such as acquisition opportunities, financial return on an investment portfolio, or a sort of big hedge against a total disruption to your market.
Right. Yeah.
But what we sort of kind of found is that actually when you analyse those, that perhaps there are quite different stakeholders within a business for those different elements of value. And what we were sort of seeing was that in some cases where we were meeting people who were saying, oh, I'm having a bit of trouble because I'm losing support, was there hadn't been this sort of clear mapping of what the different elements of value they were going to deliver for and aligning the right stakeholders for each one.
Yeah.
So you might have started off your program saying, this sector is exploding and this is a good use of capital and we're going to sort of make a financial return. But then 18 months in, when you haven't shown much of a return and perhaps you might be underwater in the portfolio, you then start talking about cultural change, but the finance director says, well, that's not really my brief. You came to me saying you were going to make me lots of money.
Yeah.
Or conversely, you get people who are started off doing pilot programs, which might sit under an innovation director, but actually they find a technology which they really love and they think, we don't want anyone else in the sector having this. So then they start saying, we need to take an equity position here, or we need to try and buy this company. And then that switches from an innovation director into a sort of M&A director type conversation.
Yeah.
And so I think what we sort of learned is that really mapping all the areas where you think you might deliver value at the beginning, identifying who the stakeholders attached to they are, getting them together from the start and having an honest conversation about who's going to see value when is really important.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
actually where you haven't done that exercise, that's where you might run into trouble. But I mean, the good news is that it's never too late to do that. It's always worth doing that exercise, whatever stage you're at.
No, very much agree, because I think that and it's that ongoing then alignment, as I would term it, of the purpose and the process and the people and the performance measures. And it's getting the organisation to understand that's going to change over time and that as well, because new startups, new technologies, chief executives are going to change and all that. You've got to keep that alignment and going as you move forward.
You have, and I think as well then you need a frank and honest conversation about risk as well, because by definition you're getting into areas which have perhaps a different risk profile from a lot of the main activities of the corporate. If you're making investments, you're likely going to have write-downs before you have successes, and those write-downs are going to hit the P&L. And so suddenly, you know, you may have thought you were operating in this kind of great space where you're taking all your money off the balance sheet, but the minute someone has to write a loss down to the P&L, you're involved in a very different set of discussions.
Yes.
So again, I think the sort of having a really honest, realistic conversation about what the bumps in the road are going to be before success is really important. And there's a tendency for all of us involved in this area to sell it in a lot on the possibility and the excitement, and we can all point to the startup companies which are transforming whole sectors, and we've just got to make sure that we balance that excitement about the potential with the realism around what's going to happen along the way.
Yeah, good. So you talked a bit about how you're applying these lessons, so you got any specific key insights there on doing that?
I think what we sort of kind of found is taking the time to do that value mapping at the beginning is not only useful in terms of that sustainability, it's a really great way to build that stakeholder support, because it's getting everyone you encounter within a corporate to really think about their part of the business, how it might change, what the possibilities for change are, how it might be disrupted if they don't change. It's a really great exercise of helping people sort of think, I guess, a bit out of their sort of day-to-day challenges and about where new solutions might come from and new challenges might come from. So we think that value mapping exercise is incredibly kind of powerful as a sort of stakeholder buy-in tool,
yeah,
as well as
yeah.
kind of getting the success factors aligned for sustainability in the venturing activity you're doing.
Good. And so what's next?
I mean, I think we're really passionate about this area. As investors ourselves, we see with our portfolio companies that, particularly in the time of uncertain stock markets, I think exits to corporates are going to play an increasingly important role in realising yeah. value in the startup economy
yeah.
over the next decade.
Yeah.
So for all sorts of reasons, we're passionate about it. But it's a pretty nascent sector, really, in many ways. You know, there are lots of great things emerging, such as the academy you run. There are things like the symposium where there's great sort of sharing of learning. But it's still relatively early compared to sort of some other areas of corporate activity, which
yeah.
are much more understood and documented and taught.
Yeah.
So I guess we are we're kind of keen to see this sort of flourish and participate in any sort of form of knowledge sharing we can. And then specifically for us, the consultancy side, where we're not operating units but sort of helping people get them established, that's going really well for us at the moment, and we're growing that. And then off the back of what we've done with the Sil Ventures, we are in conversations with two or three other corporates about a similar type of model where in their sector there's an opportunity to tap into the innovation that's happening amongst entrepreneurs and perhaps create that pipeline mm-hmm. of acquisition opportunities. So my hope is we'll have at least one more launched within the next year, and potentially two or three.
Great. So, and what do you do outside building these units and startups? What other hobbies or commitments have you got outside?
Well, I mean, one of the reasons why one of the areas we started was in spirits was that my big passion is food and drink. So I blog about food at frankaboutfood.co.uk.
Right.
That's where I document the sort of food I cook and sometimes the restaurants I go to. So food and drink is a big passion outside of work, which I've been lucky enough to bring into my day job to a quite significant extent as well.
Great. Well, I'll have to show you some of the stuff my daughters do and the videos that they're creating at the moment in the food that they're into. But I've got a baker and I've got a cook.
Sounds fun.
So thanks so much, Frank, for giving us insights into the roles you're doing here. Thank you.
Thank you.